You're listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people who are waging struggles for love and revolution.
This week on Love and Revolution Radio, we discuss Sherry's recent trip to Standing Rock, the adventure getting out there, and the things that she learned from her experience. Then we dive a bit deeper into the lessons that we can apply in our own communities right where we live.
Hello, this is Sherry Mitchell for Love and Revolution Radio. Aguanu Nidups, welcome. I'm coming to you from my frigid home in the Dawnland in chilly Bunawabskeag territory, located in and along the shores of the beautiful Penobscot River in central Maine. And I'm coming to you today with a heavy heart. My cousin is missing and has been missing now for 10 days. And I'd like to ask all of you listening to the show today to please send your prayers that he will be found, that he will be returned safely to his family and to his young son, and also pray that his family, his immediate family, will have some peace during this very challenging time. We never know what life is going to offer us. It's full of twists and turns and oftentimes delivers us challenges that we don't think that we can bear. And our show today is going to be focused on my trip to Standing Rock, which was unexpected in many ways and contained its own twists and turns. The people that are standing at Standing Rock are standing there because there are things going on in this world that they can't accept. There are things going on in this world that are threatening our lives, that are threatening the future of all life on this planet. And it is our responsibility to stand up and to face those things with courage and with conviction and with commitment. And so just as the people in my community and members of my family are standing with courage to face this incredibly painful challenge that has been thrown before them, we all are going to have to be facing our own challenges as we move forward. And today we're going to talk about some of those challenges and where we are right now. And as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Ms. Rivera Sun, and I'm happy to have this moment in time to be able to have this discussion with you. Hello, Rivera.
Greetings, Sherry. Welcome back to Maine, and I'm very saddened to hear about your missing cousin, and I hope that there is a safe and speedy finding of him soon. I think there's a lot swirling around in our world that is weighing down people's hearts all over the place. There's much that people are concerned about, and rightly so. And it is also the time of year to be in touch with what's going on inside ourselves. As the year approaches solstice, as the nights get long, this is the time to start to listen to the things that we have been not listening to throughout the rest of the active and outward-facing year. So for me, there's a period of reflection at this time of year always, and an invitation to be courageous enough to look at the darkness, to look at what is really in there and what it means for us and how we can show up in these times and how we ground ourselves for doing that showing up. And I feel like many people I have spoken with recently are finding that to be their daily practice. How do we maintain the ability to pay attention to this world, to meet its needs as they seem so immense and dire? And yet how to do that without running around like Chicken Little with our heads cut off, screaming that the sky is falling and that everything is coming to an end and the worst things are happening. that reaction is not helping us actually protect the vulnerable, heal the sick, attend to the needy, stop injustice, repair harm, or create the new systems that we need. So I think today is a day of reflection. It's a day of review. It's a day of really asking questions. And where I'd like to start this conversation, and I know we'll cover lots of territory, just as Sherry, your trip to Standing Rock covered vast distances, I'm sure in speaking about this trip, we'll also cover some pretty vast distances of the issues and the things that we are all facing in our communities everywhere.
Yeah, the trip to Standing Rock was an interesting trip. As many of you know, I have been working tirelessly for the last 6 months here in my community, helping to raise awareness, helping to raise money, helping to collect supplies. Our community has sent out a number of caravans full of supplies to the people there on the ground, and this was the first opportunity that I had to go there physically to actually accompany one load of materials and supplies that were being sent and to get a sense of things on the ground. And it was an important time. Our schedule got pushed back a week, which put us there right at the time when the eviction was supposed to have taken place. Of course, that's not what ended up happening. What ended up happening is the day that we arrived there, the Army Corps announced that it wasn't going to be giving the easement to Dakota Access Pipeline to continue across the Missouri River, Lake Oahe. So everything shifted instantly. We also got there right before a major storm. We were delayed on the road, which put us there a day later than we had actually anticipated arriving. And we weren't able to get set up adequately to be prepared for the elements that came rushing into the area. So people were sleeping in cars, sleeping in the back of our U-Haul that we had brought supplies out in. Some had found some warm shelter, but mostly for 4 or 5 days, everyone was cold. I managed somehow, by some crazy twist of fate, to escape that because I was sent into town to get supplies for our group and ended up getting stuck there because of the blizzard. They closed all the roads. So I was stuck in town for 2.5 days and ended up being in a hotel room, which might have been for the best since I had pretty significant case of bronchitis going on. But everything that unfolded in a way that I hadn't expected. There was a time of transition where people weren't quite sure for a few minutes what it was they were supposed to be doing now. This action by the Army Corps seemed to deflate the action in some ways for a lot of people. And then they became unclear of what their work was there. What was it they were supposed to be doing? How are they supposed to continue standing up for this effort if they weren't standing up on the front line? And so those were questions that had to be unraveled by everybody as we, worked through the changes that were coming. By no means was this considered to be the end of the road by anyone. Nobody believed that this was an ultimate victory. It's simply a pause in the action and an opportunity for everyone that's involved in this to regroup. And I think that it came at a really good time when the weather is beginning to get really harsh out there. There are still a number of people who are there on the ground who are holding the line in case anything changes, in case anything happens, in case Dakota Access attempts to move forward without the easement. And so where does our focus go now in regard to this work is the question. And I think that question has been answered pretty clearly by the leaders of the camp. We have to continue to hold the line and support those who are staying there on the front line. We need to provide them with what they require to stay alive in those conditions, which means lots of firewood and other means of staying warm, food, water, adequate shelter. And we also have to start putting a lot of pressure on the investors. of this pipeline. The Dakota Access had been trying to reach a January 1st deadline because their contracts expired after that point in time. So now this is a critical time when they're being delayed. They're going to have to renegotiate those contracts. It's a perfect time for us to put pressure on all of those banks that are supporting them, and we'll put a link up to those banks on our page so that people can look at where to invest those efforts right now. And I think that this is really an important message to the world, that this movement is sending an important message and providing a really important example to the world that we have the ability to be able to direct the movement of these companies through concerted effort, through unified action, and to send the message to them that we are not going to support them if they are going to be bankrolling death, that we will only support them if they start moving towards activities and investments that support life. And that is our job right now. Our job is to send that message really loudly and very clearly to all of those organizations, to all of those companies, to all of the corporations who are supporting activities that foster death. This is not the only pipeline. There are thousands of pipelines across the country, and there are thousands of things going on all over the world, millions of things going on all over the world that are taking away our ability to be able to exist into the future. And we need to be able to look at those things and stop, like you said, running around like Chicken Little all the time, saying the sky is falling, chasing our tails, chasing feathers in the wind, whatever you want to say. We need to start looking at the source, because there's only a handful of companies that are behind a lot of this activity. And if we start targeting those companies at the source and really sending a strong message, divesting, withdrawing our money from banks, doing all of these things that people are doing to let them know that we're no longer going to be complacent. We recognize that we can't. And we're going to show up every day, every place that they go. And in every way that they do business, we are going to obstruct them.
Well, I think that's the crux of it. And as someone who could not go physically to Standing Rock, to have taken on the responsibility in my community for going down the list of 17 banks and figuring out which ones are here in our tiny little town, and making sure that we were getting out and encouraging people to move their money. And as we did that, we would also post online about this and make sure that all of our friends and family were also knowing how important it is to move their money. And very interesting discussions would come up, because I would always encourage people to move their money out of one of the 17 corporate banks that are financing the Dakota Access Pipeline into a locally owned bank or a local credit union. Because generally speaking, once you've made that move, you don't have to do it with the next pipeline struggle. You don't have to do it with the next export terminal struggle. You don't have to do it again to protest the next natural gas pipeline or fracking that's coming into your area, because your local banks and your community credit unions tend to actually invest locally in a much more sustainable, much more community-oriented small businesses. And so it's kind of the time for us all to make this choice and to make this move. And one of the things that people who were making the choice to move their money were finding was a lot of empathy and understanding from the bank employees that they were speaking with. Some people were not, some people had other experiences, but many people reported these wonderful conversations going on that really made sure that as customers of one of those banks, they made sure that their message was being delivered to the management, to the upper management, so that all the way up the chain of those banks, they understood why they were losing money and customers. Now, $17 million from the last report that I have seen have been moved out of these 17 corporate banks because of the Dakota Access Pipeline. This mirrors a trend that's going on globally in which $5.2 trillion has either been moved out of or pledged to move out of fossil fuel infrastructure investments. This is enormous. The global net wealth, the global money in the world, is only something like $250 trillion. So to have $5 trillion of that having moved and being pledged to move is very significant. And the UN Secretary General, or the outgoing UN Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, said that this shift to renewable energy is inevitable and it must happen, and it is very much already happening around the world. Actor Mark Ruffalo said that people who are invested in fossil fuels are going to lose those investments. It's a matter of human survival. And I think, Sherry, your point that you were making, that it is time for us to do everything that we can on this issue because of Standing Rock, but also because of all the other pipelines, all the other fossil fuels, all the other export terminals. I mean, when I look through my friends list on Facebook, when I look through my old-fashioned Rolodex, when I look through my email list, I have all sorts of friends in all sorts of communities who are impacted by fossil fuel extraction, fossil fuel burning, fossil fuel export. I even have friends who are already being displaced by climate change conditions and rising sea levels and floodplains and forest fires and things like that. It matters. It's getting very, very personal, very, very fast. And I think that when we can make that connection from the personal to the political and vice versa, then we understand that these are times in which we actually have to be engaged in this work. There are no bystanders right now. Well, you can be a bystander. It's happening. But it's really not a very wise position or strategy. It's a little bit like being a bystander as a ship is sinking. You really need to either be fixing the ship or getting on a lifeboat or helping to save other people. You need to pick your role in these times. Sherry, I wanna go back to you just a little bit more about this trip to Standing Rock. And I'd love it if you would share some of your impressions of being there. Now, I know there was a blizzard going on, but you were also there right as this major turning point moment occurred, not the end of a struggle, but perhaps a certain battle won. And I would just love to hear you share more reflections from being on the ground.
Well, when we arrived, there were fireworks going off at the Oshodi camp, and there had been a lot of celebration by the people who were there. And there was also a lot of skepticism. People thought that it was a ploy, that it was meant to take away the power of the veterans coming in. Another group of people was kind of convinced that the whole thing with the veterans was set up in some way. You know, I mean, people are just so distrustful at this point of anything having to do with the government that there were all kinds of speculations that were floating about. I think that the feelings were so mixed on the ground during that time that it was hard to get a sense from the whole group that there was one unified way of seeing what was happening. I think that there was a lot of concern by people who didn't have all the facts about how that came to be, that they were just trying to get people away from the camp so that they could come in and go through anyway, because Dakota Access has said repeatedly that they don't even need the easement. They're just going to proceed without it. They're attempting now to override the Army Corps' decision by taking them to court, but their argument is based on a completely different statute. So, you know, it doesn't really hold much water. And so one of the things that seemed to even out over the next couple of days, because like I said, I was separated from my group. I was stuck with closed roads away from the camp. One of the things that I noticed when I came back was that there seemed to be a sense of quiet resolve amongst the people that we stay the course. We remain vigilant. Yes, this was a victory, and it gives us an opportunity to pause for a moment and to regroup. However, we need to continue staying on top of things. We need to continue doing everything that we've been doing up to this point, that we can't look at this one small victory as winning the whole thing. So there was a lot of mixed emotion around it. And I think that it also created, because people were so dug in, people were so committed. And I think that they still are. People are still really committed, but there were people that were so dug in that when Chief Archambault said, you know, it's okay for people to start going home now, we're just going to leave a small group of people at the camp to keep an eye on things, that there were so many people that had found a sense of purpose there that they didn't want to leave. And that's understandable because, you know, we're all feeling called, we're all feeling pulled to do something. And that provided an opportunity for people to funnel that energy of that call into meaningful action. And I think that a lot of people felt kind of disappointed that they weren't going to be able to be a part of this big movement that they saw happening. But that's not necessarily true. They are still having the opportunity to be a part of this big movement because it's ongoing. It's just shifting. And it reminded me of the murmuration exercise that you do that we've done in our workshops together as well, where it's about being leaderful instead of leadership, that there's not just one direction for a movement, that it needs to be fluid, that it needs to be able to move. Okay, right now we're not focusing on this one aspect of stopping them at the front line because they've been stopped by the Army Corps. So now we're going to shift our energy a little bit, and we're going to focus on their investors. We're going to focus on some of these other aspects of the movement that are critical to keep it going, to keep it flowing, to keep it fluid, to keep it alive and active. And so people are learning how to do that fluidity within a leaderful movement as they're going through this process. And it's just really beautiful to watch because they have this inner struggle moving away from what they thought was going to happen and moving into what is happening. And people are doing it and they're showing up and they're going through all of their processes on the fly. And it gives me a lot of hope. So there wasn't any one unified cry or message coming out of the camps. It was kind of all over the place from the very beginning.
Well, I think that is something about leaderful versus leadership or leaderless, is that you will have a variety of opinions and message streams and clarity and disclarity. And I think that's both a strength and a weakness in these kind of systems, these kind of movements. And so our task is to learn how to turn the weaknesses into a strength. One of the things that occurred to me while you were talking about that, Sherry, is that I was reflecting on that swarming of the murmuration and the formation at a certain point of struggle, and then a dissolving and then a reforming at another. And you were speaking about how your community was so involved in solidarity for Standing Rock and understanding the importance of the water. And this in your community predates the struggle at Standing Rock and has a lot to do with the water quality standards and the water grab of the state of Maine from the Penobscot people. And interestingly enough, upon your return or as you were returning from Standing Rock, the Penobscot River case turned another leaf, and actually quite a good one for the tribe. And I was wondering if you would comment a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, what happened was the EPA finalized their water quality standards, and this is not the Penobscot River case per se. This is a separate case that the state of Maine has filed against the EPA to fight against these water quality standards. There were proposed standards by the EPA stating that the state of Maine was not maintaining high enough water quality standards to ensure the subsistence lifestyle that the tribes have a right to, that we have rights to subsistence fishing and the right to live off from our traditional waterways. And the water quality standards were not sufficient to allow for that to happen because the amount of pollution was contaminating the fish in the water. So the EPA had proposed water quality standards that elevated the requirements of the state of Maine to meet those subsistence fishing rights. And those were finalized. So that's what the story that came out when I was coming home was all about. The tribe is still in the midst of a case involving the state of Maine's attempted territorial taking of our traditional waterways by just unilaterally saying out of the blue that we no longer have rights to our waterways. But that's a completely separate case. But it talks about our long relationship with the water, that we have been engaged in this protective action for our waterways for a very long time. And I've talked about this on the show before, that, you know, this comes together with rights and responsibilities being inseparable, that when we realized that our waterways needed to be cleaned, we didn't just stand up on a soapbox and demand a right to clean water. We took responsibility for cleaning that water up. And we have consistently been taking responsibility for ensuring that that waterway is clean, not only for our tribe, but for all users and all living beings that make their home in and around those waterways. And so we have been engaged in this active protection and upkeep and cleaning of those waterways for decades. And it's something that is going to continue to be a part of our way of life. You know, that's part of our responsibility as Bunawabskek, is to take care of the place where we live, not only for ourselves, but for future generations. And so it was a natural outcropping of that decades of work that we've been involved in for us to become involved with what's going on at Standing Rock, because we understand the significance of our connection to those waterways that are running alongside of our communities. It's not just a resource for us to exploit, that we look at that as part of our familial unit, you know, that those waterways and all of the living beings that live in there are our kin, and that we have a responsibility to take care of them. So, you know, we were able to bring all of that experience to the work that we've been doing to support the people at Standing Rock.
I think that's something we were seeing here in Taos, New Mexico as well, where the solidarity was really very much Taos Pueblo Tipa people led. And, you know, it's important to mention that it changes the feeling, the kind of organizing, the way in which the organizing is done, who's organizing matters to how the organizing transpires. And my experience with this is that it was extremely beautiful and profoundly important, and held a lesson for everyone involved in organizing to really reflect on the way that we, each of us with our own cultural backgrounds, our own dispositions, our own worldviews, insights, approach resolving a problem, and to understand that other people in our community may not approach it that same way. Some people have found, because of maybe their wealth or position, that calling their senator is a very handy and useful tactic, especially if they donated quite heavily to the senator's last campaign. For those of us who don't donate to senator campaigns in amounts larger than $20 or at all, that's not really a workable strategy for us. We have other ways that we organize. Some people like to lock down to pipelines. Other people like to walk up and down their neighborhood streets and actually get out and talk to people. And I think one of the things that it behooves us in this time to learn to respect and honor all these different strategies of organizing, but to really deeply ask what works and why and for whom. And to start to respect the less commonly called for ways that are coming out of people who are very close to the struggle, on the ground in the struggle, most impacted by the struggle, and really ask them, how would you address this problem? How would you go about doing it? It's really at the heart of what community organizing is. And just seeing the organizing here in the community of Taos, New Mexico, which has many diverse cultures, seeing the organizing around Standing Rock being led by Taos Pueblo people was very profound realization of how who we are matters to how we organize, and why it's important to really think deeply about that. And we'll be back for a quick break for a station ID.
I think that, you know, the piece about asking the people on the ground what they need is so critical. One of the things that is very challenging in doing some of this work is that you have people that come to it that want to help, but they want to help in the way that they think help is needed. They don't want to ask the people on the ground what they really need. They don't want to ask them how they think the problem should be solved. And there were a lot of people that felt that the media and others were giving all of this credit to the veterans coming in at the time when the Army Corps denied the easement, that it actually diminished the work and the recognition of the stance that the tribal people had been making for 3 years. You know, this isn't just the movement of the last 6 months when people have been on the ground there. This has been going on for 3 years. So the tribe has been opposing this pipeline. And so, you know, recognizing those who are a part of the movement on the ground, where it's happening, recognizing their voice, recognizing their wisdom, recognizing their connection to that place is an essential part of us being able to create successful movements going forward. I think that it also gives us this incredible opportunity in a microcosmic way to solve some of these macro problems that we're facing socially. It's Standing Rock, one of the most beautiful things that I've seen is the fact that there are people there from all walks of life, from all over the world, who have come together with one heart and one mind to address this problem of a threat to our life. And they've been living there in what have been very difficult circumstances in such a beautiful, prayerful, and peaceful way. Of course, you're going to run into personality issues here and there, but the majority of the experiences coming out of the camps have been really positive. People have been having this really incredible experience of connecting with others in a heart-based way, in a unified manner, to protect what is most sacred. And that's having this profound impact on people's lives. I had a young girl contact me and say, I just can't take it. I can't take it. Everything just seems so awful in the world. I can't stand what's going on at Standing Rock after the incident on the bridge where so many people were injured, where the Morton County Sheriff's Department and the National Guard was spraying people in below freezing weather with water cannons, shooting them at point blank range with rubber bullets when there were all of the head injuries, all of the bruises and contusions. And when Sophia Wolonski had a grenade tossed at her arm, that, you know, this young girl was feeling overwhelmed by the violence and the destruction that she was seeing at the hands of these corporate actors towards peaceful, prayerful people. And when we start thinking about how that plays out on a larger scale, we have to think about the duality, that all life is a duality and that there is a mirror that's being shown here. You know, the big, bright mirror of corporate terrorism has been reflected pretty clearly by those operating on the side of the Dakota Access Pipeline. But on the flip side of that, you have humanity at its finest showing up to stand nonviolently, to remain peaceful in the face of such horrific violence, to remain prayerful in the face of such despair, and to remain hopeful that they were going to be able to be successful if they continued to stand together. And this is the longest sustained action, I think, in the history of this country, where you have people that are staying in one location for such an incredibly long period of time with so many people together in that one location, living directly off the land, living in very close quarters. There's a lot of shared housing that's going on there. People are bunking up with one another because they need to stay warm, but also because, you know, they need to preserve space. And so, you know, you have this human experiment going on of us all bringing together all of the skills that we've been learning along the way and demonstrating the power of that at Standing Rock and the significance of that, not only to this particular movement, but the significance of that knowledge being placed out into the world going forward can't be overstated. I think that we are showing a whole generation of people what it means to stand up to the power of destruction with the power of love, with the power of hope, with the courage and commitment to life that they've all been demonstrating, that nobody is going to forget that, that we have a whole new generation of people that know what that looks like, that know how that works, and that we're going to be activating and awakening all of those people who are seeing this from all corners of the world to stand up to what seem like insurmountable forces. We've heard these stories from history, but now we have a living example of that that is going on right here in this country at Standing Rock, and I think it's incredibly powerful.
I think that's such a great point about a new generation learning from a tangible experience of nonviolent action at work, that every generation or every decade or every era of humanity witnesses some form of organizing. And knowing older activists and organizers has really taught me that the ways of organizing in the civil rights movement versus the Vietnam anti-war movement versus the anti-nuclear movement of the Clamshell Alliance and other alliances versus the anti-globalization movement and its summit hopping tactics and techniques and so on and so forth, that every incarnation of this has a slightly different flavor, slightly different approach, and it behooves us to study from them, to learn from them, but also pay attention to what's happening in front of us and on the ground, and to learn, to not just blindly repeat tactics that have happened in the past, but to understand the strategies behind them and the depth of organizing that makes those strategies successful. That's one thing that has been really impressed upon me by some of the older veterans, I would say, of nonviolent movements who have seen people applaud their successes with their tactics, but be completely blind to the depth of organizing and commitment that those tactics required. One thing that comes to mind is the Montgomery bus boycott, many of the campaigns of the civil rights movement, and the depth of training that was required, and that same quality that you described, Sherry, about what happened on the bridge and many of the actions that happened at Standing Rock, of the dedication and the perseverance and the commitment to nonviolent discipline, that is absolutely essential. And it's a noted phenomenon. It's completely necessary for having any chance of aikidoing the violence that's being directed at your movement. That it doesn't happen every time, but it does happen often enough for scholars and researchers and organizers to know about this phenomenon. But when nonviolent demonstrators can meet violent repression without retaliating with further violence, the use of violence actually backfires, as it did against the Morton County Sheriff's Department. And the movement finds support flooding to its side, sometimes very literally on the ground in people, and sometimes in terms of financial or material support, and then sometimes, and quite often this is the case, in terms of actions by other people who are stepping in because they don't agree with the use of violence that just happened. And we very much saw that around the North Dakota government. We saw that around one very clear example we saw it around was the emergency response police teams that were sent to North Dakota, that many of them were recalled, and then others, when I don't know what you call it for police, it's not a tour of duty, but when their time was up in North Dakota, the pressure of the citizens of the other states made sure that their time in North Dakota was not renewed, which it could have been. So I think we're seeing a lot of these dynamics at play, and I feel it's very important for people to be aware of it because it helps us understand why we commit to nonviolence there are moral reasons, spiritual reasons, but then there is also this particular pragmatic, strategic reason, because this Aikido effect never happens if you retaliate with violence. In fact, your use of violence often then creates a backfiring against your movement, in which you see support flooding away from the movement very rapidly and very quickly. It's probably one of the single most important things for people to understand when they're looking at what's called the diversity of tactics and whether or not to allow a violent flank to become a part of a nonviolent movement that they're a part of, is to understand this one particular strategic dynamic of nonviolent struggle.
I think that's a really important point, and it was something that a lot of us were watching with the violence being aimed at the protectors at Standing Rock, is that we were worried that someone, anyone, would have a moment of breaking, have a moment of weakness where they lashed out in violence. And I think that it's incredible, with all of the thousands of people that were there, that nobody did. I mean, it's just really remarkable statement to that movement and to the leaders of the camp and the people who were there on the ground, who have committed themselves to that nonviolent stance, to hold the line nonviolently in the face of horrific, brutal mistreatment. And when we think about the actions on the bridge, when all of those things occurred, when they were actively assaulting the people that were there, the peaceful protectors that were there on the bridge, the public outcry from that was astounding. They tried to lie about why they were doing it multiple times, but there were so many people that were standing there videotaping and live streaming the events that nobody believed them. Their lies held no weight out in the public arena, and people started to wake up even more quickly. The amount of support that came in after that event was astronomical. Now, people really started to understand the importance of what was being done there. They started to understand what we are facing, not only as Indigenous people, not only as local residents at Standing Rock, but as a country and as a global society, in the face of this type of corporate industrial terrorism, where their behavior is so completely out of line, where they are willing to not only destroy habitat, not only destroy the ability of people to live in a certain region because of their destruction and contamination of that local area, but their willingness to be able to physically and violently harm anyone that stands in the way of their profits. That we have seen these types of things in other parts of the world, specifically in Central and South America, where so many people have been disappeared by these companies that go in. They all have their own militia. They all have their own security detail. The security detail for DAPL is a group of former military special forces who formed their own security company, and they're providing security for this company. And why is it that a company in what is supposed to be a free economy needs to have military support, military protection for the things that they're doing? You know, we need to start thinking about that. We need to start thinking about what that means in regard to how they conduct business, that they need a military to support their really destructive swath of violence that they're committing against the planet and the people, and what that means to all of us in the way that we are living. We have to start looking at the way that ways that the laws are being manipulated and how law enforcement is stepping up to support industry who is violating the law. The Dakota Access Pipeline Group, they're violating the law. They don't have the proper licenses and permits to continue. They don't have an easement. And yet they've pushed and pushed and pushed their way forward, and they're being supported by law enforcement as they're breaking the law, and law enforcement is breaking the law in their violent and excessive force being used against people who are exercising their constitutional rights. Everybody needs to be questioning that and looking at what that means. And they need to be looking at the effectiveness of this strategy that you and I promote all the time, which is nonviolence. And looking at the power of that in the face of these atrocious behaviors and tendencies on the part of both the corporations and on the part of law enforcement.
One of the things about that nonviolence and nonviolent struggle that it's really important for people to be very clear about, and our listeners to Love and Revolution Radio, you probably get this point already, but it is more than just demonstrating, it's more than signing petitions. Those are good, but keep on going. It's more than even just blockades and putting your own body on the line or risking arrest. Those are important too. It's a coordinated, well thought through strategy about how you're going to use every nonviolent tool in your toolbox to deny an oppressive force the resources, the materials, the human resources, the authority, the legitimacy, the intangible things like our sense of fear of them, or our sense of hope, or our sense of despair. Deny them everything that they need to continue to advance on their devastating path, while simultaneously giving all the support that we need for a new system that wants to emerge. And I like, Sherry, that you brought this whole topic right home to people's lives, that if we were upset by what's happening at Standing Rock, we need to look around at our own community and see, is our community on an energy source that pretty much requires a military to ensure that it's going to arrive at our doorstep in our home? And what does that mean for us? Are we actually on the side of this injustice? Now, I think anyone who says, wow, you know, I don't want that kind of power feeding my home, and starts to organize in their local community, will very quickly find themselves in their own version of Standing Rock, their own version of the challenges that require nonviolent struggle and courageous organizing to make that transition happen. Because the powers that be that hold the power that we use are not going to let it go easily. They're very attached to it. They've demonstrated that quite clearly. But we know that as citizens and human beings, we are really going to have to very clearly say to the screaming, temper tantrum throwing oil and gas industry, I'm sorry, you need to put that down. It's dangerous. It's hurting us. We can't be using it anymore. And if we can give them another thing to play with, just as you would with a toddler, that would be great. And if not, then we're going to have to let them screech and scream and be very upset about this. But we, the people, must stand up. And we have the tools to do that. I think that's something that you and I, Sherry, try to really remind people of, is that we have the capacity to do this nonviolently. It's well demonstrated, and it's really very much time for us to do the work in our communities.
I think that one of the things that, you know, we should mention before we close the show today is this dance with the shadow that we're all doing, that people have been resistant and they have been reluctant to look too deeply into the shadow and into the darkness at what might be lurking there. Now all of these things are being forced into our vision as the light gets elevated, more and more things that are in the shadow come into our focus. And it's really important, I think, to just sit with those things, to be able to lean in to that darkness a little bit, to not only see what might be lingering in there from some other source, but what else might be lingering in there in regard to our own way of viewing the world. That shadow aspect is just as much a part of our lives as the light is. That, you know, as I said earlier, all life is a duality, that we all have the light and the darkness within us. How do we get connected to what is in that darkness? How do we begin to understand it? One of the things that I think, you know, we all have to learn as we're growing and evolving is that we are made up of multiple parts. One of those parts is the shadow. One of those parts is the darkness, that is the duality of the light, and that we need to be able to sit with that, to be able to be comfortable looking at what's there and then determining how best to respond to it rather than react to it, because there's a lot of reactionary behavior going on right now around the world in response to the shadow. And, you know, a lot of the things that we see in there are distortions from our own misguided views. And how do we correct those views? How do we address those things? How do we dance with the darkness? You know, in our mythology, we call it the dance of the cannibal giant. Others call it the dance of Kali. And the Kogi calls it the dance with the gods of chaos and destruction. So there's, you know, all of these different views, all of these different stories and mythologies surrounding this particular time that are ancient. This is not the first time that we've faced this kind of events like this. There have been many times in our history when we have faced incredible darkness, and how we've responded to that has shaped the immediate and long-term pathway forward for those who were engaged in those particular challenges. And so right now we have this opportunity to step into this time, to kind of lean in and to decide how we want to respond. How do we want to engage that darkness? How do we want to engage that shadow? Do we want to engage it once again in destructive ways, or do we bring something new to that dance? Can we maneuver it in a way that doesn't lead to quite so much destruction? Can we maneuver it in a way that honors that this is also an aspect of us? And how do we bring that aspect into harmony and balance with the rest of the movement around us? And, you know, I'd love for you to offer some thoughts on that too, because I think that this is a really important piece of what we're facing right now, especially as we head toward the solstice and the darkest day of the year, where we're facing what seems like our darkest period in a very long time, that all of these things are lining up and coinciding, and that there is some real spiritual opportunity being presented to us here, and we need to really be clear and mindful about how we engage it.
I love this subject and theme, and I think it's actually very timely, as you said, as we head towards solstice. The thing about the darkness and this feeling that we're having is that solstice is also a crossroads. It's also a pivot point. It's a moment of change. It's a marker within the cycle of the year, the cycle of our experiences. And I think that on one level, this happens as a great revolution around the sun, but it also happens moment by moment by moment for each of us in our lives, that the tiny little and the huge, enormous cycles are always presenting us with an intersection or a crossroads in every second of every moment of every day. The choice for us is, what are we going to do? And within the tradition that I follow, which is largely Buddhist inspired with a liberal dose of Taoism and paganism thrown in for good measure, the meditation practice is about cultivating awareness in the sense of breath before you go barreling down the same pathway that you've been on for a long time. That if every moment is a crossroads, usually we're just racing along willy-nilly on one path without even an idea that we're streaming right through intersection after intersection after intersection. And the thing that we're called to do is to, as you said, Sherry, stop the reactionary, habitual, or fear-based response to everything that's going on. Take a moment, take a deep breath, and find a wise response so that we can spin that revolution in a new way. We can choose a different direction. We can make the change that very much really needs to happen in the world. And that's what I actually feel like we're trying to do with these Love and Revolution shows, is to actually get into these opportunities to intervene in our habitual thoughts and give people another option, another place to go. And with that, I think we're just about at the end of our conversation today.
Our time always goes too quickly, and there are so many things that we would have loved to have touched on. I'm sure that we'll hear from a lot of listeners about things that they wished we had talked about. And that's part of the beauty of it, is stimulating these ideas and conversations to continue on between our listeners and between ourselves and our listening audience. So as always, it's been a joy and an honor to be able to have this conversation with you, because these are things that people are thinking about. These are the things that people are talking about. These are the things that need our attention in the world right now. And these are the things that are not getting enough airplay over the mainstream media, which is why it's so important for shows like Love and Revolution Radio to exist. So we want to thank all of our listeners for being with us once again. We hope that you'll continue to be with us. We have a couple of special shows lined up for you for the end of this year, and we're gearing up towards some exciting things in the new year coming, which will be our second year. We will have completed our first full year next month of being on the air, which is really astounding to us. So, Rivera, thank you so much for being who you are in the world and who you are in my life. I appreciate you.
Likewise, thank you, Sherry. Thanks this week to Sherry Mitchell for her deep and insightful comments, and for going to Standing Rock and back, and for being willing to share some of those experiences and the reflections that came from them with all of us here on Love and Revolution Radio. Our theme song is Love and Revolution, with words and music by Diane Patterson. It is performed by Diane and Spirit Radio. You can find her great music at www.dianepatterson.org.
I'd also like to thank you, Rivera, for your presence and for the wisdom and the insight that you always bring to these discussions with me. As for my trip to Standing Rock, that's about all that I accomplished, was going there and coming back. It felt like the lessons and the offerings that I had intended to bring to Standing Rock were turned on their head, and instead Standing Rock taught me and gave something to me that was very personally important to my life going forward. I would like to acknowledge and thank all of those around the country who have invested their time, their energy, their hearts, and their minds in the challenges being faced at Standing Rock. I would also like to thank all of the volunteers in this region who are continuing to be out on the cold streets looking for my cousin. And if you enjoyed the things that I have offered on this program, you may also enjoy following my Facebook page, Sacred Instructions, which can be found on the Love and Revolution webpage and on the podcast. Love and Revolution Radio is a weekly radio program, and your local radio station can broadcast it. All you have to do is give them a call and ask them. You can reach us via the Love and Revolution page on Rivera Sun's website, www.riverasun.com. And we are Love and Revolution Radio on Podomatic, Stitcher, and iTunes.
For Love and Revolution Radio, I'm Rivera Sun. By the time this show reaches your ears, listeners, we will have approached or passed the solstice, which comes around once a year in the heart of the darkness of December. Solstice is a time for going deep, for turning inward, for pausing to reflect, as the nights reach their longest length that they will for the entire year. So, listeners, as the nights stretch long, maybe you'll take a moment to dance with the darkness all around us by the time we talk to you next week. What if you knew?